So I saw a newspaper this morning and saw all the disasters which are happening in the world recently, like the end of my retreat. And sometimes you think, why me? Why do these disasters have to happen? But in particular, it's at the time whenever there is any tragedy or disaster in life, there's always people ask the questions why, and they want to find some reason why these things happen or some understanding. So I thought this evening I'd give a talk entitled, Why Me? Because a lot of times people personalize the disasters which occur in life. And yeah, there are things like tragedies in life, but sometimes I'm quite surprised at the reaction people have to tragedies. As if they're unexpected. And really, we've all, at least most of you, are old enough, actually quite old, that you should know by now that this is the nature of life, to have these unexpected events which can be quite hard to handle, but which in Buddhism, I was taught from a very early age as a Buddhist, that we call these things as messengers of truth. In other words, they're wake-up calls. They're not things which we regard as great tragedies in the sense of giving us a lot of sadness and pain, but they remind us of the nature of this life in which we're born into. So instead of always saying, why me or why do these things happen, isn't it sad? Instead we look to see that this is a teaching about the truth and the nature, the reality of the life which we're living in. In other words, we use these occasions, what many people call as tragedies, as places where we can learn to live properly, where we can grow in kindness, in compassion, so we're not so self-centered, and we can also grow in qualities like generosity to help others in need, so one day when we're in need, others will help us too. My whole life I've done this, especially since I ordained, is serving and looking after others as much as I can. Even there's a 9-day retreat at our Jhana Grove right now, another group, an insight group, were there. And the other day they called because the plumbing was blocked. So, I'm supposed to be on retreat, but I know a thing or two about plumbing, having plumbed most of the monastery down at Serpentine, so I went down to fix it up. And they were saying, what are you doing, Ajahn Brahm? You're supposed to be on retreat, you're an abbot, spiritual director. What are you doing? You know, in the drains, getting all the rubbish out. And I said, well, this is just, you know, you look after me, I look after you. And isn't this what we do with compassion? And it's because they saw me looking after the drains so these people could meditate. It's not just teaching them how to watch the breath. But my job is actually to facilitate them, because when you unblock the drains, it's like you unblock the blockage in your head, in the sewers of your brain. to unblock it so everything flows out so you're free. Because I often say, you know, that the toilet, that's the place above all where you learn how to let go. They're very spiritual, these WCs. So I want to facilitate that. But because I was helping them, they sort of helped us as well. There's lots of weeds around the gardens over there. So they've been helping, like, look after the place and weed it. And I've always find that. If you, like, help other people, they help you. And so whenever there is a tragedy, you've got so many people to help and look after you. Which is a beautiful thing about life. Tragedies can sometimes bring out the most beautiful aspects of a human being. And so sometimes without tragedies we would never see these great acts of selflessness, generosity, kindness and compassion. And that's one of the beautiful acts. But sometimes they say, yes, but people have died, people have lost everything they ever owned. And I say, And sometimes as a Buddhist you're radical, you say, well, what do you expect? At least I own something. Me, I never owned anything to begin with. Come and have a look if you're going on Arkatina Day at our monastery, on the 11th. That's usually we open up the monastery, you can see how we live. And you can see my cave where I live. There's hardly anything there. So that's why I'm never afraid of burglars. If a burglar came into my cave where I live, they'd be very disappointed. So what do you mean you've lost everything? You know, if there's like the earthquake destroys your home, or your tsunami just washes away your livelihood, what do you mean you've lost everything? When I hear that or read that in the newspapers, I think, my goodness, you haven't lost everything. Is that what you think everything is, just your material possessions? No, there's other things which are far more important than that. And material possessions, it's tough, it's hard, we can build them up again. Even family, which you lose. There's something else which is more important than even that. And that's these beautiful spiritual qualities. Your hope, your energy, your love, your positive forward thinking. Don't ever let any tsunami take that away. And this is what happens sometimes when a tragedy hits and people allow that earthquake to destroy their love, their hope, their wisdom. They allow these tragedies to take them into this negative depression of, why me? It's unfair. Why do these things happen to us? And of all of the things which can be destroyed in life, that is the most devastating. When you lose your hope, when you lose your trust in the beauty of this human life, and especially when you lose your love and respect to your fellow human beings and the universe around you. And that does not need to be destroyed. And no earthquake, no tsunami, nothing can destroy that. What I still remember, I was talking to someone just beforehand, and they said that their partner was very afraid of flying. Because every now and again you sort of hear the cases of planes which crash into the ground, or which get blown up in mid-air by some terrorist. And I told them, look, they can destroy your life, but they can never destroy your positive thinking. And that's when I told them, some of you have heard this before, but I promised I would say this. As a monk who flies a lot, going from place to place teaching, not going on holidays, my carbon footprint is well balanced by the fact that I have no children. So I'm ecologically okay. But because I fly a lot, and people have asked me, aren't you afraid of terrorists blowing up your aircraft while you're on it? And my answer is always the same. The three advantages of dying at 30,000 feet in a terrorist explosion. So anyone who's afraid of flying, please remember the three benefits of dying in an aircraft explosion. Number one, you don't have to worry about organizing the cremation. It's done on the spot for you. Now, I do many funerals. During the range retreat, about 9 funeral services I had to go to. Now, it's very busy, there's a lot of people dying. And I keep telling you, please, when the monks are on retreat, please don't die. You know, we're trying to meditate and then we have to go to your funerals, but some people are so stubborn. They've got no care for the monks, they just go and die when they want to die. Oh. But anyway, I've seen them just organizing the cremation. If ever you've organized a funeral, that's just such a lot of hard work. So this is all done on the spot for you. So die sort of 30,000 feet, instant cremation, no worry. Number two, for those again who have organized funeral services, how much do they cost? Usually $6,000, $7,000, $8,000. That's a lot of money. What happens if you die at 30,000 feet? It's not as if you don't get any bills. You actually get money from the death. They give you, you know, insurance. They give you a payout. The airline actually gives you all this money. So it's a very rare occasion when your death actually gives your family a bit more money. It's a very kind and generous thing to do for them. So that's number two. You get money out of the death at 30,000 feet. But the best benefit of all, of dying in an aircraft explosion, a disaster at 30,000 feet, is at that altitude, you are so close to heaven, it's very easy to go the next step. So there are three advantages of dying at 30,000 feet. Now, you've heard that before, but some of you haven't. But the point is that in disasters, it's always the positive attitude towards it. And that's the thing which I don't want people to lose when this happens. Because it's so easy to get into that negativity and depression of why me? Why do these things have to happen? It's not fair. And then we get into anger, blaming, all sorts of things. It's amazing just how many people, when things go wrong, blame others. Soon, actually coming pretty soon, maybe next month, we get the, you know, in Perth here, you get the TEE examinations. All the kids in year 12 having to do these examinations, which their parents insist are going to be so important. But if they do well in those examinations, their life will be sweet from now on. And so it's at this time, this month, next time, we get a lot of Buddhist students come into the monastery for some praying, please, give me some chanting. And of course, what happens when they fail? Who do they blame? Me, for not chanting hard enough. And it's really unfair. I didn't do anything. I'm just chanting. It's you that are doing the studying, for goodness sake. But when there ever is a disaster, how many of us blame others? Instead of even not looking upon it as a disaster, but looking upon it as this another opportunity. Imagine if you fail the TE and you can't go to university. At last, you finish with studying. Oh, what a relief. And you can get a nice job. You don't have to get a degree to do well in life. There are many, many, many people who are not good at passing examinations, are not good at studying, but are really wise and clever and skillful in their work. So we don't always have to think in the same box as everybody else and do exactly the same. And as I often tell people, if you fail your examinations and you can't get a job at work at Bodhinyana Monastery in Dhammasala, we're always hiring. We'll always give you a job. And it's a good job as well. I don't see why. In fact, I want the Buddhist society, when we have all of these at universities, they have all of these corporations hiring. They have these stalls there, you know, careers days. It's about time, I think, the monks and the nuns had a stall there to recruit more monks and nuns for our world. Because why not? We can do a huge service for other people. Number one, we live a very simple lifestyle. So, you know, we're not consuming so much and eating up the resources of this planet, creating so many greenhouse gases. You can't be more environmentally, ecologically sort of frugal than just being a monk or a nun. At least you're not increasing the world population. And you can look after and serve other people. The amount of good which a monk or a nun can do, teaching, caring, helping, is huge. And it's monks and nuns, we're the ones who go and teach psychologists and psychiatrists how to do their jobs. You know, we teach the carers how to care. You know, just as an aside, I went to a lecture at the law school and I heard that somebody say that the job of a doctor, a nurse, a psychologist or psychiatrist, their job is to heal the sickness. And I said, no, that's not true. Certainly not in Buddhism. A doctor's job is not to cure their patient. Absolutely not. Otherwise, if they think that's their job, often they will fail. And I've known doctors who've come up to me and said they tried so hard and had this tragedy of like a young wife or a kid, and they tried so hard to cure and they died and they feel terrible. I said, no, you're missing something here. The job of a doctor is not to cure, but to care. To care, that's your job. A psychologist, psychiatrist, nurse, whatever, your job is to care for that person. And if you manage to get a cure, which most of the times when you're caring for someone, you can heal their pain and their sickness. But if you can't heal their pain and sickness, and they die, at least you've cared for them. And what a wonderful gift that is, to care for people. So that way, as a doctor, as a psychologist, psychiatrist, nurse or whatever, you never fail. You've always cared for people. But if you think your job is to cure, to heal them, you will get frustrated and you will get angry when you cannot fulfill your aim in life. So let's make it more easy, but more profound. Your job is to care, not to cure. If the cure happens, that's a bonus. And it usually does. If it doesn't happen, you've cared. And I think many of you know that. You've been with dying people. You've been with sick people. You know they're not going to be cured. But you're caring for them. And that's what they need more than anything else. And it's the same with in tragedies. Sometimes you can't stop the tragedies. They happen. Deaths happen. But what we can do, we can always care. And that's the beautiful thing about the tragedies, whether it's an earthquake, whether it's a tsunami, whether it's losing the ashes, I read that as well. Whatever tragedy there is in Australia, I don't know how the Sri Lankans are doing, they're supposed to be playing cricket as well. Has that been a tragedy as well for them? They're nodding, I think, maybe they did lose. But whatever it is, we can still sort of care. Which means there's always something positive we can do, even in the most difficult times. But still it begs the question, and it's one of the questions, why does this happen to some people? And why is it always happening to me? That's what most people think. Why is it always me? And actually it's not just you, it happens to everybody. As you, as me, as everybody. So no one gets out of this. And that happened when the Boxing Day tsunami, people would ask me, is that karma? Is that what Buddhists think? Is there karma that they happen to be in the wrong place and they're killed by the tsunami? Is it their karma that they happen to be sort of in Sumatra when the earthquake happened? Actually, one of our members, I don't know if he's here, was in Bali when the earthquake happened there. And I asked him what it was like. And he said that actually was in bed. It actually got him out of bed in the morning. That was quite difficult to get some people out of bed in the morning. But I think the only problem, he was quite safe because it wasn't such a strong earthquake. I think the only problem was that morning, the only thing they had for breakfast was scrambled eggs. That's a joke. Come on. Earthquake, scrambled eggs. Only thing they had for breakfast. Anyway, so when these things actually happen, I asked, why do they happen? And that was something which always worried me when I was young. Why do they happen to some people and not others? And the story or the incident which really made me, sort of made it clear to me, was this time when, again, I do repeat these stories, but it's been 3 months since I last gave a talk here, so hopefully you forgot most of these. But this was a story when I was with my teacher, Ajahn Chah, in Thailand, and he would receive guests. They would come and ask their problems, and he'd give these amazing answers. And one time this man came to him, and he was disabled. And the reason he was disabled, because he had been drafted into the Thai army and he'd been wounded in a firefight on the border. And he was disabled because, you know, a few bullets had gone into the wrong places in his body. And he came up to Ajahn Chah and said, "Why did this happen to me? Now, what karma did I do? You know, can you look in my past? And what karma did I do that I got shot and I'm now disabled?" And without missing a beat, Ajahn Chah said, "The karma which caused that injury was you joining the army." See, because that's what happens when you become a soldier. You shoot bullets at other people shoot bullets at you. What do you expect? Some of those bullets are going to hit. He said, that's what happens when you're a soldier. And he said, in the same way, that when you join the human race, when you become born into this life, this is actually what's going to happen to you. Not every soldier gets shot, some do. Being born as a human being means you're open to getting cancers, tsunamis, dying at 30,000 feet. Many, many ways which can happen to you. That's the karma, that's what happens when you get born. As I've often said to people, before you're born next time, please read the contract. It's all written in there before you sign it and take birth. You may die of a tsunami, you may die of a piano dropping from 30th story on top of your head. There's many, many ways, but you're open to each one of those. And understanding that, that was something which was very profound, means that this is part of our life. We can expect one of these things to happen to us. When we expect it, there's no more do we say, "Oh, why does this happen to me?" We say we can expect this, that our life is totally uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen next. Remember last year, about 4 or 5 months ago, just after giving a talk, a man came and talked to me and actually died right here, had a heart attack, you remember that? So that degree of uncertainty in life, some people are afraid of. But as for someone who understands, it doesn't actually elicit fear. It elicits this beautiful sense of being caring. This day counts. It makes life more alive when you don't know what's going to happen next. One of my favorite sayings, and I mention this to many people, is never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. How many people waste their days doing stupid things, meaningless things? So that's the stuff to put off until tomorrow. And the most important things, and you all know what those important things to do, that's what we do today. That's the lesson of earthquakes and tsunamis and cancers and the tragedies of life. Really, it teaches us what this life is all about. It does teach us about care. It does teach us about prioritizing. And when you look at life, people have some really weird priorities. Now, for example, on the 10th of October, we're having our Katina ceremony at the nuns' monastery. And on the 11th, we're having a continuous ceremony at our monks' monastery. These are really important events. So you should prioritize them. Forget about doing the washing. Forget about taking the kids to the sports. Forget about mowing the lawn. Prioritize. No, but what you should really prioritize about is always being kind, being generous, being loving. Remember what is important in life, because that's what tsunamis and earthquakes and other tragedies, that's what they teach us. That's what cancer teaches you. I don't know how many times I've been teaching at cancer groups, and how many people have come up to me And they've said this amazing sentence. They say, the cancer was the best thing that ever happened to me. It actually taught them the meaning of life. Now, they can come and listen to monks like me. They can listen to things on the iPod. They can go listen to preachers. They can go look on the TV, though, to inspirational preachers or talkers, or read books. But there's nothing so powerful as your own experience of life. And when those experiences hit, they really remind you about why and how and what this life is all about. There we have the choice. These are reminders. They are what's called, they are a Pali word the Buddha called Dhammaduta. These are the messengers of truth to us, which actually remind us the meaning of life. They remind us that we don't need so much to be happy. You don't need the big houses, big cars. You don't need the big bank accounts. You don't have to worry so much about whether there's a green shoots of recession or whether they're all going to sort of wither and die. You don't have to worry about so much things when you know the important things in life, the simplicity, the kindness, the love, the friendship, the fellowship which you have. As for me, again, you don't have any money. I don't have any health insurance. I don't have superannuation. I've got no nest egg for when I get old. But am I worried? Of course not. What is my insurance? What is my nest egg? What is my superannuation? It's all the good karma I've done in the past. And I know because of the service which I have given, the kindness and the friendship which I've given in the past, I will never want for anything. In fact, every time I have got slightly sick, I've always had to hide it. Because a few times when I've coughed in public, the next day I've got 10 bottles of cough medicine. And their donors insist that I drink theirs. And they're all different. You've got homeopathic, you've got Ayurvedic, you've got from the chemist down the road. And they insist that I have to drink it because they've brought it specially for me. And as a monk, it's very difficult because they come up with such kindness and they've really gone out of their way to get this and bring it to you. And if I don't drink it, I feel terrible that I've actually hurt them. They've done this wonderful, generous act and I haven't responded by taking it. So I take some of theirs and some of theirs and some of theirs. And then I'm really sick. But the nice thing about it, though... Nice thing about it is just kindness, and it's nice being in that sort of wonderful situation of just being kind. So sometimes that's my health insurance, all of you. That's my superannuation, because I've been kind to you. I think you'll always look after me and feed me. Now you're learning about what matters in life. And no tsunami, no tragedy, no earthquake can ever take that away. So when people say they lost everything, I think you don't know what the important things are. The important things is your good karma. I mean your kindness, your generosity. And that is what we prioritize. That's what tragedies teach us. Whether it's Samoa or whether it's Sumatra or wherever these tragedies hit, they will recover if they have these beautiful social networks, these support groups, the families, the friends, the places where love and generosity are very, very strong. That's what brings people through the tragedies of life. But in societies which are fragmented, where people don't even know their next door neighbor, those are societies which haven't got, you call that the spiritual insurance policy. They haven't got that friendship, that love, that care where everyone looks after one another. And those are the places where if a tragedy hits, it hits deep and it hits hard and it's very difficult to recover. So I'm sure, because I've been to Indonesia many times and you know the sort of the close-knitness of those societies. They will recover. I know this close-knit society of Samoa, they will recover. Why? Because they haven't lost everything. They've got each other. I remember just after the tsunami over in Sri Lanka and Thailand, I went to those places afterwards. And I remember the last time I went to this orphanage, which the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, which I also get involved in, was supporting, and also some funds from here, from this Buddhist society, went to that orphanage as well. And just to watch, you know, the kids grow over those years, and just to see just the strength of that little village society, of people looking after one another and having fun. And there you saw these kids who'd lost their parents but had each other. And there was a family, and it was a happy family, it was a fun family, and it wasn't dysfunctional. You see that, and you know that, you feel that. You see, the tragedy has been overcome. They haven't got much wealth, but they sure have a lot of happiness and a lot of hope. Now those are the things which we understand for tragedy. We understand why it happens, because this is karma. But the important part of karma, which I often say, is not why it happened and blaming someone or blaming God or blaming Buddha or blaming whoever, the government. Instead of actually blaming things, the law of karma in Buddhism is, don't say why it happened or why me. The question you should ask is, what am I doing about it? Or rather, what are we doing about it? Because the law of karma is always work in progress. It's not fate. Oh, this had to happen to me, I have to sort of suffer, it's my fate to suffer and not to have any happiness. Sometimes I get into that and say, why do I always have to give the talk? All these other monks have a wonderful time in my monastery doing the meditation. That's why we call it a rest time. You know why we call it a rest time during the rains retreat? Because the rest of the monks can go and meditate and I have to receive all the guests. That's why we call it rest time. It's all right for the rest of them, but not for the boss. But instead of saying, why me? And some of you might think that, you know, at home, why do I always have to do the washing? Why do I always have to take out the garbage? Why do I always have to do these things? Why does it always happen to me? Now, that is not understanding the law of karma. That's getting into the negativity. Instead, we say, what am I doing about this? And when we say what we're doing about it, what karma are we doing with what we've got? How are we relating, responding to these events of life? And that's something which you can always control, your response reaction. What life gives to you, sometimes just we can't control that, but how we respond to it, that we can. You can't guarantee that you won't be in a tsunami or an earthquake somewhere. You can't guarantee that you won't get cancer or you won't have these other tragedies which happen to life, because that's part of life. But you don't need to be afraid of that. Instead we say, when it happens, how are we going to respond? How are we going to react? And that's something which spiritual life can give you. The ability to respond in a beautiful, positive, amazing, wonderful, generous, compassionate way. And that's the heart of the training, learning how to respond well. So when a tragedy hits, instead of getting negative, we say, what are we going to do about this? And there's always something you can do with whatever hits you. Was it last year we had the bushfires in Victoria? In 1991, for those of you who remember, we had an enormous bushfire which swept through Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, and I was there at the time. This was, at the time, the hottest day ever recorded in Western Australia, or in Perth rather, 46 point something degrees. A couple of weeks later, it got even hotter, but on that day, a big bushfire, a crown fire, came through Bodhinyana Monastery. When the fire came, the temperature was above 46 degrees. I don't know how hot it was. But it was an amazing experience to see these trees explode like bombs going off. Because how the bushfires work in those very hot days, the eucalypt leaves and the bark, the eucalypt oil vaporizes, and you have this sheath of combustible oil mixed with the air, just waiting for a spark. And those sparks come, and you have these explosions, bombs going off. It's amazing to see. And we had to evacuate. And I thought, this monastery which I had built, you know, I always said at that time there was no building in that monastery which didn't have my blood on it. So I wasn't such a good builder. You know, so I've cut myself, hit my fingers with a hammer and all sorts of stuff. Every building had my blood on it, my DNA. And it was all gone. The fire had come and destroyed it. You know, I never blamed anybody. I never thought, oh, this is a tragedy. I thought, it was well worth doing, building that monastery. It doesn't matter, tomorrow I'll start building it again. As it happened, nearly all the buildings, I think there was one caravan which was burnt to bits. Everything else was okay. It was a bit of a miracle. Even the head of, you know, now they call it FISA, the bushfire brigade, he came to inspect, and I remember being with him, taking him around some of the buildings there. And I remember him looking at one of those buildings and looking around, underneath, all around it, and then turning to me, and he said these words I'll never forget. He said, "Ajahn Brahm, this should not be here." But it was. So, you know, we've got other ways of protecting things. I wish only our insurance company would realize that and lessen our premium. But nevertheless. So when those things happen, it's how you react to disasters. And because of my training as a monk, you know, for so many years, I meditate, you've got this positive attitude to it. So, okay, never mind, we'll start building tomorrow. And I remember just being evacuated, and of course the TV cameras there, I think it was Channel 9, interviewed me, you know, for the evening news. And said, you know, what was it like? I said, oh, the fire came this way and that way. And apparently, you know, that reporter was so taken that I wasn't upset. I wasn't negative, because usually people like start crying. I've lost everything. I worked so hard for that monastery and it's all destroyed. God! But, you say, okay, never mind, she'll be right. And because of that, actually the reporter rang me. She wanted to do a whole program on me later on because, you know, that she never actually came across that reaction before. Because that was actually a tragedy. That was a huge fire. And the whole thing looked like it was going to be destroyed. I thought it would be destroyed. But there was no negativity there. There you were in a tragedy, but you knew how to deal with it. And that was a wonderful thing with the spiritual life. The tragedies which you experience in life, there's always something you can do about it. Getting negative, complaining, getting angry, even grieving. Who does that help? You have the choice. You can't stop earthquakes. You can't stop tsunamis. You can't stop cancers. You can't stop accidents happen, incidences, car crashes, suicides, untimely deaths. But what you can do is react to it in a totally different way. As that reaction is under your power, all you can do is care. You can't cure. You can't stop these things. But you can always care. Care for people who have lost things. Share your life with them. Share your resources. Share your house. Share your money. Share your food. It's a wonderful thing to be able to share with someone else. Every morning when I have my breakfast, the cat comes up to steal my milk. We've got a couple of cats in the monastery. And I happily give the cat my milk because I get more fun seeing the cat licking my milk than drinking it myself. Isn't that the case? Seeing someone else be happy because of your resources. That's why people volunteer to work at the Buddhist Society here. They don't get paid when you work here. I don't get paid. I'm thinking of sort of getting a union, but no. But you get so much happiness giving, and actually people get more happiness volunteering in charity organizations like this than they do if they do the same work for money. It's not the same when you're doing it for pay than if you're doing it out of love. When you do it out of love, you're sharing, you're giving, you actually get more happiness out of this. So when there is a tragedy, it's a gift, an opportunity for each one of us to share, to give, to love, to help. And it's those acts of kindness and generosity which really mean something. It is my custom when I give talks to tell jokes every now and again. And people always give me research, joke books to read during the rains retreat. And I read this very funny story about this very, very wealthy man driving in his Rolls Royce. And you know, fortunately, Australia didn't really suffer too much from the recession. But this was one of those countries which was really doing it hard during the recession. And as he was driving down, he saw two poor men eating grass. Imagine that. Having nothing to eat and having to eat grass. So he stopped his Rolls Royce and asked, "Why are you eating grass?" And they said, "We've got nothing else to eat. We're so poor and hungry. That's all we have to eat." So the man said, "Get inside my car. I'll take you home with me." And the two men said, "Well, look, it's not just us. It's our wives and children. Bring them in as well," he said. "The more the merrier." And so, this rich man took these desperately poor people back to his mansion. And on the way they said, "Sir, you are so kind. You know, we always thought that rich people were very stingy. We are so kind. Bring us back to your mansion." And he said, "It's nothing, it's nothing. When I saw all of you eating grass, I thought of my own lawn. The lawnmower is broken, it's 3 foot high. I need all the help I can get." That's a story. No, some people are like that. Mean he said, they're going to really have a terrible time next lifetime. But no. when we could really share our life instead of sharing our grass, we get so much more happiness. And that's what we can do. So when we have tragedies, there's always a choice. It's an opportunity for us to make good karma. So when you do find someone who's suffering, then it's an opportunity for us to care, to help. Because sometimes we can't cure that suffering. We know that there's people here who feel for you, who care about you, who want to actually to do something, if there's anything we can do to make you more happy. And that makes a beautiful part of tragedies in life. And sometimes, quite frankly, we do need those tragedies. Unfortunately, for people to care. Every time you go and visit someone who's sick in hospital, that's one of the wonderful things about being sick. You find out how many people care about you. And it's quite humbling sometimes when you're there in bed and all these people come and they really take time out. And they're very busy, we're all very busy. Doesn't matter what they have to do, they're going to take time out to come and see you, look after you, and just spend time with you. What a wonderful thing it is when you realize just how difficult it is these days for people to come and visit in hospital. And you're the center of this beautiful caring process. So next time you are sick, don't ever feel guilty about being sick. Don't ever feel you're taking up people's time because you can't do things for them, for yourself. Really, as a Buddhist, I think it's a wonderful gift to others when you're sick. A wonderful opportunity for other people just to ratchet up their compassion and their care and their love so they can have someone to practice their compassion and care on. And that's on you. So the tragedy of sickness instead becomes a beautiful celebration of mutual care. It also, as far as your spiritual life goes, shows you that you're not in control of your health, no matter how well you look after your health. sometimes you get sick anyway. So when that happens, you realize you can't control your health. You know, you do your very best, but what you can control is your reaction to health and sickness. When you're healthy, work hard, serve, look after your loved ones and your community. Don't waste your energy. And when you are sick, it's your opportunity to be a generator of care and love towards all those people around you. And it also shows you how to be humble as well. Realize you're not in control. It's one of the deeper teachings of Buddhism, when we realize who is in control anyway. Nature is in control. Nature owns our body. Nature just owns this earth. And according to natural causes, there's earthquakes, tsunamis, there's cancers, there's mobile phones, it goes off. It's no one's fault. That's the nature of mobile phones. And you get so many people in the room, you can't expect everyone's mobile phone to be turned off. So it's just the law of advantage, law of probability, that's all. So you don't get negative and angry and want to sort of excommunicate sort of the person whose mobile phone was not turned off. It's just life, that's all. So you can see this is a good example. You have like someone's mobile phone goes off. How do you react? You cannot control this. I know sometimes, you know, the person says, can you all ensure your mobile phones are turned off? But it never happens. And so instead of like being control freaks and having these people in the Buddhist society with peak caps and batons and tasers, that's not the way of Buddhism, is it? Instead of trying to control you, we accept you and understand, yeah, they go off, so how are we going to react to that? What are we going to do about it? We can't actually control that, but what we can control is our reaction to when these things happen. Every time you're irritated, someone says something or does something which you don't like, or you do again, have the tragedies and disappointments in your life, you get sacked from work, you know, you get laid off, you know, your relationship falls apart, or your kid doesn't do well at school. How do you react to that? That is what you have in you can control, your reactions. And the beautiful training here is to learn how to make good karma no matter what you're experiencing. To learn how to react to the tragedies in life in a beautiful spiritual way rather than a destructive way. Tsunami can destroy houses, but it doesn't have to destroy people's lives. It can destroy people's bodies, but it doesn't need to destroy again people's hopes and care and love and friendship. And you usually find it actually makes those friendships, that care, that love, stronger. That's what usually happens. So, you have that choice, how we react. So be careful. Don't just react in the same old way that other people are reacting. Oh, isn't it sad? Isn't it terrible? Isn't it really awful? Look deeper into these things. And you'll find that when we don't react to things with negativity, when we see other opportunities, other avenues, other ways of dealing with these things, we find we're free of so much suffering and difficulty in life. Much of the pain, much of the dukkha in life, we create. Not the world creates these things, we create them by our stupid ways of reacting. One of the stories which I was inspired by was I read that, I think we get an Economist magazine during the rains retreat. There was this person who was accused of blowing up this airliner, this, I think, Libyan man, the Lockerbie bomber it was called. And I think the Scottish government sort of sent him home because he had cancer or something, was about to die. And I thought, what a wonderful thing that to do, what a wonderful compassionate act of that Scottish government. I was actually quite disappointed when I found out that many people, especially in the United States, were just so disappointed and angry they were doing this. And I thought, gee, where is your understanding of justice and compassion? Sort of torturing that guy, killing him in jail, that's not going to bring all the people back. Is that what you demand? For actually to overcome people's pain of losing loved ones in that terrible aircraft disaster? that this is a stupid way of people thinking. You don't get anything except anger and pain when you cultivate ill will and want revenge. So when these things happen to you, don't want sort of your pound of flesh back. Who caused this? Who's responsible? And live with anger. I think, was it correct that event, the plane which exploded over Lockerbie, that happened about 25 years ago or 30 years ago or something? That's such a long time to keep and harbour, you know, the real bad cancer of anger and ill will and revenge. Why can't we just forgive and take the high moral ground of being a society which can respond to tragedies by saying, too many people have been killed already, too many people have been hurt, we don't want to hurt anyone else. Please go home to your family and die, you know, amongst your loved ones at peace. I thought it was a beautiful gesture of the Scottish government. I can't see why other people was too scared to stand up for kindness and just capitulated to the hard people who just wanted their pound of flesh. As a Buddhist, we have forgiveness. And as was in last year's calendar, when somebody, well, it was one in Singapore anyway, when someone asked me, how many times should you forgive? The answer is always one more time. There's no end to forgiveness. That's a high spiritual response. As far as justice is concerned, that works its way out according to the law of karma. When we have a tragedy, a disappointment, our job is to care, not to hate. We can't cure. We can't stop these tragedies. It would be wonderful if we could find some system, early warning system or something, to stop the tsunamis wreaking such havoc, to stop the earthquakes, to stop the wars and the bullets and the bombs. But I don't think we can. What we can do is to change our responses, the way we deal with these situations. And that is the message of this talk this evening. Not why me, or why does this happen to us, but it's here, what are we going to do about it? And when we start from that point, what are we going to do about it? A whole motorway, a whole freeway of opportunities opens up to us. Beautiful ways of growing from the tragedies in life and making beauty where other people just see so much pain and hurt. Another way, the way of karma. So that's the talk this evening on how to deal with the tragedies of life. And has anyone got any questions or comments about this evening's talk? About what's happening in today's world. No questions? Going? Okay, we got one from there. Okay, you're finding difficulty forgiving some of the terrible things which happen in wars. Not just in wars, sexual attacks on children. Some of those things are just very hard for people to even comprehend, let alone to forgive the perpetrators. The paedophiles, the rapists, the torturers, and in all forms of life. But as a Buddhist, instead of looking at the justice system, we had the two prison officers come to visit our monastery a couple of weeks ago, and they were saying, look, as far as they're very, you might say, ahead of the game prison superintendents, and they were saying, our whole job is not to punish, but to rehabilitate. Actually, to move people out from that terrible situation where they committed those heinous crimes. Our job is not to punish, but to find a way of moving those people back into society so they never do those things ever again. They learn from them. They can pay back society in many other ways. I know maybe I was moved once by Dostoevsky's famous novel, Crime and Punishment. And it was the ending which moved me the most, because at the end of this novel about a student, they detailed why it was he murdered his landlady. You can actually see just the causes and effects. A terrible wrong thing to do, but you can see why he was led to do that. And in the end, they said that his little time in jail was not going to be his punishment or his retribution. That he would pay off that crime with his service to humanity in the later years of his life. And I thought that was a wonderful insight of Dostoevsky. If you have done anything wrong, a great crime, you will never pay off that in a jail. But you can only pay it off by helping and serving others. That's how the punishment, if you like to call it punishment, is dealt with. Taking a person who's done a terrible act and saying, the only way you can balance that is not by punishing you back, putting you in a jail, torturing you, confining you, whatever. Your job now is to pay back. Not pay back in the indigenous sense of punishing, but pay back you owe society. Give. That's a different way of looking at justice, but that is far more beneficial to society and to the individual. I've worked a lot in prisons when I was first here, and one of the moving experiences when I was in jail teaching these people was when one of my students in jail, Nick, still remember his name, I arrived early to the meditation class. He grabbed me and said, come. I don't know what he was showing me. He took me to the schoolroom, and there was a board with all these cards from kids. He told me where this card had come from. The week before, this fellow was in for dealing drugs, a drug dealer. And don't think that's benign. That causes huge amounts of social problems. The local primary school was doing a course on the danger of drugs for children. And the principal of the school said, now what expert can we get to teach our children how dangerous drugs are? Some social worker, some professor from the university, some doctor. And the principal of this school was brilliant. She said, let's get a prisoner. Someone who's doing time for drugs. Who else knows as much as such a person about what drugs do to you? So they managed to pull it off, getting two convicts doing time for drugs to teach year sixes on the dangers of drugs. Now, I don't know whatever happened to those kids, but I'm sure that they understood better than any other kids from such a teacher about why you should avoid drugs. There was someone who was hurting desperately because they'd done drugs. But even more than that, I saw the effect that had on that prisoner. Because those cards, this is what they do in primary schools. The next day, teacher said, art class, let's draw some cards for Nick and his friend in jail. And these cards were saying, thank you so much, Nick. Hope you get out of jail soon. Love, Jenny. And as this prisoner was showing me these, he was weeping. He was crying. His cheeks were soaking with tears. He'd actually done something, repaying a little bit of his debt. That is what healing is. That's how justice is served. Unfortunately, few people have got the guts to actually do such things. So that's how forgiveness happens. And that's actually what you want to do. If you've done something terrible and bad in your life, we've all done terrible bad things, to pay it back, no punishment, no guilt, but service. And you feel just so good about yourself. You have actually done, made a difference. You have paid off your debt. So that's how I look at things. Does that sort of answer the question? Helps, okay. Okay, so that's enough for tonight. That's the first talk. I'm a bit rusty, but I hope it was okay. And there's more coming next week, and the week after that, and the week after that. So, thank you for listening.